What we do need to talk about, though, is I think we hinted on it a little bit last time, but like it deserved its own its own full conversation, and that is this Flint water crisis, man.
My goodness.
Like, I mean, at this point, you know, no one. I think, you know, you had to have been kind of under a rock to at least like hear that there is a crisis going on. But
does anybody know how it got, like how it got that far?
I mean, basically you have
and why isn't it just now? Because the water didn't just turn like that over like a week.
No, it didn't. So Governor Snyder of Michigan. Governor Rick Snyder, man. So there was basically this conversation about, or not conversation, but a decision to save money, mm-hmm. to shift water supplies for Flint. They used to pull from Detroit,
Lake Huron
or whatever. And it's like, and so they made this decision then to say like, okay, we're going to shift to a cheaper water district, a new water district, and that was the Flint River. Is that where they?
Yep. They were pulling their water from the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, which was sourced from Lake Huron and the Detroit River. Mm-hmm. And they switched to the Flint River because it would help save some money.
Yes.
And have y'all ever been to Flint before?
I've been to Flint. Yes. And shout out to, I don't think anyone talks about this group ever. Have you ever heard of a rap group from Flint, Michigan? Called Top Authority.
No, I haven't.
Man, it's from back in the day, like 91, 92. Uh-uh. And just, I think being from the Midwest, anybody from anywhere close to Ohio, we were like, we on.
Yeah,
like,
we got support. We got support.
Yeah, man.
They
but
sold
shout
five
out to,
records, but
absolutely,
we on it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we, you know, it didn't
Flint
matter.
Flint is probably one of the top four depressing cities in the world.
That's most of Michigan, but and most of the Rust Belt, to be very honest with you.
So,
but
Adam Thomason, who's a friend of the show site or whatever, he lived in Flint, pastor in a church. Mm. He just recently moved 2 years ago, so he used to tell me about Flint all the time. And
it's trill up there.
Yeah, it's like real.
It's very, very real.
And so for them to decide to switch water reservoirs from,
it's bad. And what sucks is that, like, so one of the the EPA inspectors discovered it, but then there's like protocol for like what you're supposed to do with that. And so that EPA instructor talked to their regional supervisor who's in Chicago, a Chicago EPA representative. Yeah. And they're like, well, this call to switch this has to be done from the government. Like, we make the recommendation, but we don't
formally, like,
yeah, we don't, like, it's a behind the scene, like, we can alert them to this. It was just so many levels of breakdowns in which
that's bureaucracy, that's government's finest.
It's so very bad. And the thing of that I think is so terrible about it is, like, because it's lead, because, like, you can't change that. Like, there's no remedy. There's no cure. There's no anything. We're talking about, like, I mean, I think the estimates of
12,000 kids.
Yeah.
Affected.
Like,
isn't this weeks after there were like video and footage of schools in Flint and Detroit, and there was protests from teachers? Am I making that up?
No, I mean, they've been telling them this for over a year, though.
And they were like, they went through certain classrooms and there were holes in the ceilings. They were showing pictures of bathrooms and there was like a big hole next to a toilet in the wall. It was just ridiculous. Like, and it was like the education conditions in the schools. And they were like, this is unacceptable.
I mean, aside from that, I'm talking about like cognitive defects, like rashes appearing on like actual skin, like goodness. It's not just even like the condition, it's the actual physical. This is in your body at this point. Mm-hmm. Like,
when is Legionnaire's disease the same thing as these high level lead in their blood, or
it's
is
a
it,
secondary it's another thing that also and I think that there's been an uptick of, I can't remember the percentage, but you shouldn't be getting Legionnaire's disease.
I thought it was an extinct disease.
It's just
dirty water. Bring that to you, bro. Bring it to your doorstep.
What the quote that I loved about this, and then we'll kind of get into a discussion about it, like responsibility wise. But a Virginia Tech engineer, Mark Edwards, was sent to Flint to study, which, Adon, this may have been who you're talking about, to study the water supply. His team found extremely high levels of lead, and Edwards said the authorities' actions exposes a new level of arrogance and uncaring that I've never encountered. Which is, I mean, it's crazy to me just how all this has happened. But swinging to the extreme, Michael Moore, the infamous documentarian, has been on multiple talk shows basically calling for the governor's arrest for negligence and the murder of countless individuals, and then the sickness.
Murder because people have died from water poisoning, poisoning in the water, stuff like that.
And just the long-term effects that right. And in fairness to the argument, Michael Moore just happens to be one of the, if not the most famous resident from
from
Flint. But like, he is by no means the only person calling for the firing and the arrest of Governor Rick Snyder. He just happens to have the bullhorn because that's what he does. From Flint.
If this is true, if there's any proof that there has been negligence, right? First of all, the decision to save money, I think, shows some negligence, because you should know the condition that the city of Flint is in order to like choose to get water reserve from a river that's in Flint. I don't think that's a good decision, right? Because there are certain rivers that run through cities that you don't want to pull your resource from. So I will say that if there's any evidence in credence to the fact that there's any kind of cover up or that there was a delay in an action,
that's where you're closer on the mark.
Absolutely, he should be indicted.
The delay part, because University of Michigan found the high lead levels in January of 2015.
Okay, so this has been a year.
Over a year. By February, the first home in Flint tested positive for elevated lead levels at nearly seven times the EPA's limit. By April of 2015, children were testing positive for lead linked to corroded plumbing. All right.
Oh, absolutely.
All of this was being made aware to them at this point, and they kept being told, like, don't, you know, you're wrong. Like, don't worry about it. We've tested whatever from the top level. But,
So look, let's take it to another level.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the families that are affected, because now you got kids who are going to the doctor. They're going to the hospital. They're missing school. They're probably already struggling financially, because Flint is not known to be a city known for its middle class or its upper class. So you probably have a lot of struggling families who, one, are struggling health-wise. So that takes away from them having to work. People are probably losing their jobs because they're missing work because of sicknesses, or having to take their kids to the doctor. Kids are probably missing school. You know what happens when your kids miss school? Social services, they're hitting you up. They're knocking at your door, wondering where your kids are. So there's a lot of social and financial implications that go into the governor being negligent in handling this issue. And so if worse, the city and the state need to be chunking out a whole bunch of money in civil suits to folks who've been affected by this. And yes, he needs to be indicted. It's about time for politicians and authority figures to not just get fired. Like, so what's the five police officers who were caught on tape beating the black gentleman who was running, and they kept saying stop resisting arrest, but the tapes were released a year later,
right.
Yeah. And they were fired. Nobody was I hope I'm not misspeaking. I don't think anybody was indicted,
right.
But everybody was fired. Not everybody was fired. A couple people were fired, and other ones had to resign.
Right.
But guess what? Them folks will probably get a job somewhere else in some other police department. It's about time for folks that they need to start getting indicted for the misuse of authority.
What I know that, so John Good was telling me a story, John Good, poet who featured on the set list, but he was talking about how like he, when he was 9 years old, like he had a, he peed in the pool. Like, he's 9 years old, right? That's and it was one of those joints where, like, the coloring changes in the pool. And no. So it rats you out, like, yo, whatever. But they pulled him out and they tried to arrest, like, they wanted to arrest him or whatever. Like they called the cops on, he's 9 years old, like, in Virginia. What? Yeah. Now, clearly, they didn't go through with prosecution. He left. But the fact that public urination in a pool warranted police to show up, according to, you know, whatever. And yet, this is like, nah, it's beyond the pale to consider, you know, yeah. some level of legal recourse, you know, in a criminal context. It's, man, this is crazy. It's really, 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 really crazy. But so, Dan, what are your thoughts around, like, the, like, you view that as a maybe an extreme use of the police, of our justice system, I guess,
to call for
the arrest?
I think if you can prove that there was negligence and that he knowingly said, look, there are a bunch of poor people, no one's gonna care, this is gonna save us $5 million.
That's kind of a hard thing to ever prove, like, someone like that level of intent to be like, oh, this is, they're poor, so we won't do this, right?
Or I think, there was a meeting that said, hey, this is going to be dangerous mm-hmm. for these people. Mm-hmm. Yes, or continue or don't continue.
Got you.
And for him to simply at that point say continue, yes, he should.
I understand.
He should be charged with negligence. It's hard for me to take the side of politics here, but I can understand the side of politics where someone takes office
mm-hmm.
and there's momentum in politics that it's hard to change as a single person.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that there's been bills that have passed. There's been things that have happened in office that Democrats would look at if we took this view and said, how dare you?
Mm-hmm.
You've betrayed our party. You betrayed the people in Chicago that mm-hmm. you came out of. But in reality, Obama was powerless against a House or against a Senate to really do anything about it. So again, I am not defending this man.
Mm-hmm.
But like Russell Simmons came out today and said, the Flint water crisis is environmental racism. Now, I agree with him that it is environmental racism by a product of how we have dealt with the lower class in this country and gentrification and pushing people into the margins
mm-hmm.
and saying you can go exist here. And we kind of have used economic racism in a way that continues to perpetuate mm-hmm. Ideas like Jim Crow, separate and equal.
Right.
But to say that the governor, Rick Snyder, is responsible to defeat that system, that's a lot.
It feels like a stretch in your mind around, like,
I don't want it to be a stretch. I want to see a guy go into office and say, hey, look, mm-hmm. there's a system that mm-hmm. has put 90% of the low income African American community
mm-hmm.
and we've pushed them from a gentrifying Detroit, which whoever thought Detroit could be gentrified,
mm-hmm.
but we pushed them into Flint mm-hmm. and now we're deciding to push them subpar water.
Yeah. So I'll just say this, on my estimation, like, I don't go to the racism part of this. Mm-hmm. Like, personally, I don't do that. I think you can make the argument.
Sure.
And I'm not necessarily here to talk anyone down from that argument. But that's not my argument. My argument is American citizens, regardless of color, these are citizens of the United States. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you, for whatever your reason was, right? That's why I'm like, I'm not trying to litigate, was he a racist? Was he not a racist? In his, should we do this? Should we not do this?
Right.
All I know is that these people were under your watch and under your purview. And you made a cost-effective decision as you saw it or whatever to say, like, hey, we're going to switch water supplies. I think we can save money. I think he's a CPA by trade or whatever. He has these thoughts about how we might be able to balance books a little bit better. Obviously, Michigan doesn't have a surplus of you know, finances, and so we're going to, I can understand that argument or whatever, but I just know that it's even said, right, by early summer, since it's already, since you had the University of Michigan saying like, hey, you have high lead levels, ignore that, whatever. The one thing that we have documented is that by early summer of 2015, EPA had a good handle on the problem. An employee wrote a memo in June 24th, 2015, saying a major concern of public health standpoint in the absence is the absence of corrosion control treatment. Recent drinking water sample results indicate the presence of high lead results in the drinking water. This is showing up at homes with lead service lines, and this is common throughout the city of Flint. This was literally given to them in June of last year. In July, the state of Michigan advised Flint residents not to worry, and they said anyone who has concerns about lead in drinking water in Flint can relax. It does not look like there is any broad problem with the water supply freeing up lead as it goes to homes. At the end of the day, this is what their government told them. Even though they were making legitimate claims, they were all those situations that you, those dire situations you were describing, show about families saying like, look, this is brown coming out of my, you know what I'm saying? Like they are saying, yeah, like I'm noticing differences. My child is slower to respond to things, right? Like I'm seeing rashes, I'm seeing developments show up. They're, you know, my child is sick every other, like I'm having to go through all of this, but you're telling me, no, it's okay, just keep drinking the water. Like that to me is where you have this profound and yes, criminal neglect.
Yeah.
And that is where I have to side with the side that says like, look, man, we got to look to see somebody and some people, in my estimation, are culpable at this point. And so I don't dismiss the criminal aspect out of pocket at all.
I think it's important to, because I just read a few of, because we've all focusing on how we got here, and we can all agree that what is happening is, it is criminal right now. But I think to understand, well, where can we go from here? Mm-hmm. What can we do in the future? How can we like break this? Mm-hmm. We have to understand like how this whole situation happened. Mm-hmm. And it always goes back to money, right? Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you have Flint, who from 1967 until this year had been sourcing its water from Detroit. And in order to save $5 million, so the city of Flint actually tried to switch to the, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Karangandhi Water Authority, which was a new $233 million thing that was built off of Lake Huron.
Mm-hmm.
So they were going to switch, and the Detroit Water and Sewage Department blocked it because they didn't want to lose the money, mm-hmm. right? And so basically a few things happened. That's how the governor got control of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Secretary of Treasury, Andy Dillon, approved the switch. So they say, okay, you can approve the switch. But then the Detroit Water and Sewage Department said, great, you just screwed us, we're going to screw you. Your water is going to be turned off in 2 months, and the new facility is not going to be done for, like, I think until the end of 2016. So that's why they were like, we're going to shut your water off, and now you need to find a new source, thus the river, thus the lead, thus where we are.
But we also have city council members back, like, in January of 2015 saying, okay, they were appealing to city council members of Flint, appealing to the emergency manager, saying, hey, let's just go back to the Detroit water system. Okay. Detroit said, fine, we'll waive reconnection fees. You don't even have to, we won't even charge anything of that. The request, though, was denied because they viewed it cost too much.
Wow. So someone wanted to see this thing go through, because if it's reconnected at that point in time, the chances of them now really going back through all this whole process to go to so
you can look at it and say, well, Detroit just wanted to keep the, you know, the money side of it, so they're like, hey, we'll waive a reconnection as long as you come back to the fold,
yeah,
that's fine or whatever.
But see, the part of this conversation that's so frustrating to me, and I don't know the geography of Michigan that well, but let's move it to Atlanta, right?
Okay.
Let's say College Park, because East Point and College Park has water issues itself. Like, where does East Point get its water from? But let's just say, let's say College Park is Flint, Michigan, right? Mm-hmm. And the city...
College Park.
Like, the state is trying to determine where is College Park going to get its water reserve from. This would never even have been an issue. It wouldn't even go in this far if Johns Creek was the name that we're talking mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. Because they know, one, they make too much money for us as a city, and that particular part of the county is a moneymaker, right? And so the moment we try to make some decision like that, we're going to have people of influence who live in that community or who have connections who are going to complain, and they're going to make sure, so they know who they're picking on. Like, they know who to, it's just like, yeah, you know who to go and punch, right?
Yeah.
And they're punching Flint in the mouth because they realize they can get away with punching Flint in the mouth.
Right.
If this was Johns Creek or whatever affluent neighborhood in Michigan.
This is Troy.
Right. So if this is Troy, that would have happened. And by February of 2015, either Detroit would have accepted them back mm-hmm. or the situation would have been remedied mighty quickly. And that's what I'm saying. So it may not be a race thing, right?
Right.
Because I'm also, I believe racism is so fluid nowadays, and it could be intentionally racist or it could be systematically racist. But I also feel like now classism is just as much of an issue, and it just so happens the people who fall on the wrong end of the class spectrum are usually minorities.
Sure.
So when you talk about a city like Flint, Michigan, you're talking about a poor community of people. And there's white folks and there's Hispanic folks and there are black folks who live in these poor communities, and they know that they can pick on this community. That's where I'm saying, like, there's neglect. There's intentional neglect from the governor down to the city council, because they know they can get away with it when you deal with a city like Flint.
Sure.
That's all I'm saying. And what's interesting, though, is I was reading an article and I noticed that there were militias there in support and help of trying to, I guess you could say, protect, as they call themselves, militias of white men in the city of Flint, Michigan, supporting the aid of water supply. So that was kind of interesting in the sense of seeing these gentlemen in camouflage and weapons standing outside schools and stuff like that. So.
Interesting. Well, so one last thing I hate to go take it back to Russell Simmons, but he had this quote that I would love kind of for us to talk about. Mm-hmm. He said, if ISIS had poisoned 100,000 Americans, we would call that an act of terrorism. This is worse than Watergate. People didn't die in Watergate. This is our children's lives we were talking about. So the point is what constitutes terrorism in this country, and what is negligence or politics or systematic oppression, or is systematic oppression terrorism by a new name?
Absolutely. I would say I'm not necessarily saying this exact instance is terrorism, but yeah, systematic institutional oppression is definitely terrorism. You think about particular systems and structures that were introduced to America, especially in the South after the Reconstruction, whether it be the Ku Klux Klan, vagrancy laws, lynching. Those are that's terrorism. You're terrorizing citizens of the state. You're intentionally going about terrorizing them so that they can make decisions that favor you as the group of people who are bringing the oppression. Now, I do feel like this can be a form of terrorism, but I don't know enough information to go ahead and say that and make that statement. Now, I think the principle of what Russell Simmons is saying is absolutely true. There's something about when you juxtapose international terrorism versus I guess you can say the plight and struggle of people here in America,
domestic
issues that I think that are tantamount, but we don't see them as that. So ISIS can kill five Christians that nobody cares about in Syria, right? Because you really don't care about those Christians. What you care about is the fact that at some point you think that that terrorism is actually going to come over here to America. Like, because I think the testament to that is that you don't even realize those Christians don't even believe the same kind of things as you do. Right? Because Christians who believe that here in America, you don't even call Christians. You call them something else, right? Because they don't believe the Trinity in the way you do, or they don't believe in the deity of Christ in the way you do. So you wouldn't even call them Christians, like true evangelicals.
Are you saying that to me? Because I'm kind of, you're like,
no, I'm not saying, I'm just saying like, saying that in general. I'm saying that like in general, yeah. I'm coming at you right now, Dan.
I'm like,
be ready.
Geez.
Be prepared for a rebuttal.
You're right.
In three.
Don't know what they believe.
But what I'm saying is there are very few people. There are some people who genuinely care about persecution overseas. Like, so I'm not nullifying that. But what I am saying is, like, say there are five people killed over here, and then there could be people who are killed in America who don't affiliate with your particular belief systems, but they were wrongfully killed, and it's clear that they were wrongfully killed, but there's no uproar about that, and there's a particular group of people group in America who fear for their lives genuinely. Like, I don't necessarily fear for my life in the way that I used to when I was 18 and 19 when police officers came around. Like, I know that tension. Right. When I was in California growing up and I'm driving around with other black kids, our teenagers and adults, when we saw the police officers, I was scared.
Wow. Yeah.
Right? But now as an adult, I'm like, hey, look, and part of that, well, yeah. So now that I'm as an adult.
Can you finish that?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope, because that was fuel for fodder.
All right, because I was about to jump in. But
yeah, now so and so today I don't necessarily have that fear. Not saying that I don't think that I can be got just as quickly as somebody who didn't deserve to get got that has gotten in the past. But saying that, I just don't. I think my thoughts and opinions of policing has matured, though I think the institution is very corrupt in itself. I do find a need for it. Like, I do think police officers are necessary. I'm not about the protests and the removal of police officers. I do think the policing institution needs to change a lot, but I do think there's credence for them.
And but then it's also that other tension of like being like, okay, we might have aged ourselves out of the target demographic of
to some
police.
Degree,
to some degree. Right? Because it, you know, yeah, whatever. Because we haven't, but we might at least have gotten to that point. Because I feel you. I was same way. I feel you. But along those same lines, it's that other tension of being like, man, I have a nephew, I have little cousins, I have people that I still feel that same concern
fear.
With, and that fear, and that. Like, yo, man, just text me and let me know you made it home. Just because I don't know. I don't know. And they're not older. They're not at the same point that I'm at in terms of like, you know, learning or understanding or having that level of like, you know, not reacting the way you want to react to a certain situation. And so to me, that level of vigilance that I have to expend and apply to those younger than me who are experiencing that level of micro and macro aggression and terrorism on a day-to-day basis, it's still there and it's still present. I'm not necessarily sure, you know, in terms of what Russell Simmons actually
you put it earlier. Look, I'm not going to necessarily herald that, but I'm not going to talk him down.
Let's
shout Russell. He actually went to Flint, Michigan, and he's there and actually doing something, which leads me to a question. But real quick, you guys talking about police brutality, we need to shout this out. Leon Bridges released an amazing music video, probably the best music video of the year.
Did you post this on?
I did.
I didn't get to check it out yet, but
I posted
will.
It on our Twitter. I'm planning on writing an article about it tomorrow. Which I'm sure I'll write, and then Adon will get mad at me because I'll post it before he has a chance to edit it.
You gotta stop doing that.
So good.
But it's amazing. And
is it a song off his album?
It's River.
Oh, that song is amazing.
It's amazing. This visual is the closest thing I've ever seen to a perfect music video.
Wow.
River is my song too.
And it deals with police brutality. And it's like,
I'm trying
it's
to figure
this
out
like
how, like,
I know. Just go watch it. It's like he's basically singing that song to people as they're suffering.
Yeah.
And it's like,
yeah. What I'm also curious about is, because obviously, like, Leon Bridges, right, is a CHH enthusiast. Mm-hmm. He's a fan of many, mm-hmm. many CHH artists or whatever. But it's also that thing of like, if he came out initially as like a Christian gospel singer,
and I did a show with this, that dude years ago.
Okay.
Years ago in a small little church in Dallas.
Understood.
And so, yeah, it's interesting.
The but point you understand, you yeah. understand what yeah. I'm saying? It's like this level of, to back to our earlier conversation, it's such, and he, obviously Leon Bridges isn't out there like, you know, with super questionable anything. No, yeah, whatever, no. whatever.
If you listen to his music, it's clear. But like, it's just, what he's saying. Yeah. Right? People like, oh, he, there's some faith, there's something, somewhere in this music, this brother believes in,
yeah.
in something that seems close to either Judaism,
right,
Christianity, something.
But
that's
it's
a
so,
convenient, that's a convenient gray area, right?
I guess I to some degree, that's what I'm saying, is that like, it's particularly, you know, when you're talking about that hard line, secular, sacred divide that certainly black
yeah.
come, like, I ain't heard Jesus. That's what I know. I ain't heard Jesus.
Hey, he talk about some girl who go to Sunday school, yeah, but I ain't hear him say no about Jesus, though.
That's all I'm saying. And it's just so funny how I remember, like, I remember that had to be introduced to me. I didn't know there was like a sacred secular music divide until like junior high, no, high school actually. Uh-huh. I was dating a preacher's kid, and she was like, "Oh, you can't do that.
You can't listen to that music."
Like, which what is so is sad. This is it's weird. Just, why can't music exist?
I think because of the sacredness of music in black culture and history, Black History Moment. I think because of where music and what music means to us and how we told stories, and because we're orators and because we're folk.
Yo,
the folklore.
So I'm gonna get on my hotep real quick too.
Okay,
and say this. I'm also think that there's a level of white privilege and white supremacy that was passed down to us in the America iteration of Christianity to us, right?
Uh-huh.
We are people heavily rhythmic, right?
Uh-huh.
The drum was looked at as something that was
absolutely.
Evil.
Absolutely.
And that was taken out of our culture.
Absolutely.
To where the church I initially grew up in, church which was a disciple, it was a Disciples of Christ church, uh-huh. actually.
Okay.
And like the church split up about the introduction of drums. And
there's
you want to be like black
written.
People.
There
like,
are books written about the concept that rhythms, drum rhythms are demonic.
Absolutely. And I'm like, this is a vestige of
exactly.
white supremacy in the way in which that coloring mm-hmm. around cultural hegemony and the way that was actually picked and choose between these ideals are godlike. These are actually,
right.
you know what I'm saying, evil and demonic.
So, yeah, I think it's a culmination. It's a spangle of all that stuff. Like, yeah. it just, you take the intimacy or the sacredness of music, you take, like, as he says, the homogeny of feeling like, well, this is what white worship looks like, or this is mm-hmm. what we've been told white Christian music should sound like, and then you fuse all of this together and you get this hodgepodge of ridiculous belief sets, right? And that's why
being passed off as
yeah, and that's
like
why
actually acceptable.
Jazz was
all,
you talk about people who thought jazz was an over sexualized music, jazz. And then,
well, jazz meant sex, like literally the term jazz means sex.
I didn't know that
jazz means sex. So if you look at Gwendolyn Brooks, uh-huh. We Real Cool,
yeah,
We
yeah,
Strike
yeah.
Straight,
we,
uh-huh. that poem was actually banned initially. Because of the line, "We Jazz June." It's "We have sex with the woman June." And so the actual term jazz actually means sex. So
look at this. I'm
jazz
like,
is created. jazz was created in very dark, damp, like crevices or whatever. And that's why the comparison with hip hop is so apt, right? Because it's these discarded leftover places that this music came out of. But it's a beautiful music.
Right, so, I mean, but if you talk about like before that, the bebops and the so, it seems as if what happens is every inception of music within black culture
oh,
gets
yeah.
it has this
rock and roll,
this fight. It has this Absolutely. Fight that it has to, that it has to, it has to earn its way to be sacred.
Absolutely.
Right?
And it has to earn legitimacy.
From bebop to Absolutely. Scat, I mean, to ragtime, to jazz, to even gospel music.
Oh my gosh. Absolutely.
To hip hop.
Yeah,
to
yeah.
soul, to hip hop, right?
Absolutely.
And so after hip hop, it'll be something. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
So it's just the natural progression within, I think it's oppressed people in general because of all of the nomenclatures, the things you have to deal with within finding identity and, mm-hmm. and formalizing mm-hmm. identity,
yeah.
and then you talk about formalizing identity within not only secular culture but also sacred culture,
right.
So it's a difficult thing to do. So I don't know, we got from that to Flint, from Flint to what did we how did
we just went from Flint to police brutality to Leon Bridges to Black History.
Okay, that's right, because you brought up
yeah
Leon Bridges.
I apologize.
Leon Let's, Bridges is my dude. That's one of my favorite albums in the last year.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. So wrapping up Flint,
wrap what, that thing up, bro.
What can be done going forward?
I think what happened is somebody intentionally poisoned it, and they're gonna come with a solution and become a millionaire. It's like a
V for Vendetta,
a watchtower kind of situation.
I wish I could disagree
Watchmen,
with you.
Watchmen, not Watchtower. Watchmen. I was
doing
my Jehovah's Witness.
So
Kingdom Hall.
Let's be honest. Indicting Governor Rick. I always forget his last
Snyder.
Snyder.
You want to say Perry? God,
every time I think about three, yeah, I wanted to, and then I think Snyder, Three Ninjas. Sorry, get on my film level.
I don't think that's going to happen.
But if it did, it doesn't, because in reality, does it fix? I mean,
right.
It doesn't fix anything, right?
It doesn't.
Or does it?
Well, I think what it. So I, much like my stance on the racism argument of it. I don't want to talk anyone down from arresting and indicting Governor Snyder, because I think on some level it's to say, hey, your decisions have consequences, right? This is not you just losing a job. This is, you know, whatever. To your larger point, though, about the affected citizens, right, that are there, it doesn't change what has happened to them. And
but that doesn't mean that's not justice. Justice isn't always... That justice doesn't always mean that the situation is remedied. Justice means what happens is we're showing that we're exacting consequences on the people who have been misbehaving.
So my view of justice, though, in the situation would be to look at the victims and say, what possible things can be done to make this right for you? And to restore some semblance of life to you.
But that's two different things. I think to some degree that's repentance versus justice. Like, I think repentance is the act of turning away from your actions and saying, how do I restore right relationship? Right. What's been wrong in this situation? Justice is like, hey, we're bringing the hammer down on this situation to show that there's consequences for wrong actions, because there are many different reasons why we do this. One, because we want to make an example of you amongst citizenship, so people don't reciprocate this kind of behavior. John Frame does an excellent job of breaking down the 7 to 8 reasons why you perform justice, and some of them aren't to necessarily remedy the situation. Some of them are just retribution. Some of them are retaliation. Some of them are revenge.
So forgive the, because this is what pops in my mind, and I don't mean it this way, but forgive me.
You good?
How do we protect against like a French Revolution mindset where, sure, there are people that are at the top that have created systems, helped to maintain systems mm-hmm. of oppression, or in some cases created them, mm-hmm. but how do you defend against them? And like, let's just chop everyone at the top's head off. They're all at fault, and just kind of clean slate. Or is that what should happen? Just because
it shouldn't happen.
Just taking the head. I don't necessarily believe in taking the head off the snake.
You gotta cut somebody's head off.
Okay.
So somebody's head gotta get cut off.
Okay.
And that's real. Like, it's only because one, you have to show that no one's above the law. But I don't believe in anarchy. Like, I don't believe in, I'm not necessarily an oligarch either. Like, you know what I mean? I think I've chosen the right government. Like, where there's just like these, like a polity type of government where just there's a group of people who make decisions without there being like a few authoritarians that like represent or speak for those individuals. Now, I think there's a difference between just going and just chopping everybody's heads off versus making people accountable for the actions of mismanagement and negligence, as Adan so aptly put it earlier. It's unacceptable. And if that means people have to lose their jobs, because this is the thing, it's like football. Like, the quarterback gets praised when they win games, and when they lose games, it's the quarterback's fault. And if you know the position you have as a representative in this government, and the problem is that citizens are so lazy that we allow our representatives to just run roughshod and do whatever they want to do without any accountability. But when things go bad, then we expect for heads to roll, right? And so if we were more consistent, then we would probably see more decisions go our way, or better decisions made more often. And so when an authority figure, and this is why I think the Bible speaks so strongly against authority figures in a sense of creating oppression. It's overwhelmingly in favor of poor people or oppressed people, because they recognize that the reason why the world is usually in the conditions it's in is because people with power and authority put folks in those positions. He says it's overwhelmingly that poverty is caused. Poverty doesn't happen by accident. The Bible asserts this. And so if this is the truth, then that means authority figures have to be responsible for the decisions they make. And if we just allow people to make bad decisions and keep their jobs, to me, that's a problem. That's not biblical.
No, I agree. And yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. Countless times in history, it's interesting where you have this culmination of truth coming to light, where it's like, clearly there is something wrong here. Clearly this elite class or this top class has kind of perpetuated the problem, and the growing numbers of those that are frustrated by it, it grows until it reaches this critical mass. And then, yes, a lot of people's heads get chopped off, whether literally or metaphorically. And so in this case, I just don't want to see this landslide where everyone is afraid to do something or sign on a dotted line because the consequences are, someone comes to Rick Snyder and says, hey, we can save $5 million by switching the water.
You
just got
to make a wise decision. You have to make calculated
decisions. Of course he's going to sign a bill that says we're going to save $5
million. No, not necessarily. My thing is, you can't just sign it off just because you're going to save $5 million.
Okay.
You have to think critically. It's like, all right, how? Like, obviously, this sounds too good to be true. How are we going to save $5 million?
Yeah.
But what if I said there's going to be a new plant? They're going to give us a better rate on our water.
Well, this is my thing. Like, there has to be, you have to do your due diligence, right? You have to figure out, like, for instance, you do taxes, right? And your accountant or your CPA comes to you and say, hey, I'm going to make sure that you get, you know, $4,000, $5,000 back on your tax return. And you know for sure, you're like, I usually only get two or three. Right. Like, how are you getting me this extra $2,000? You get that
Wesley Snipes situation.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, man, I just basically, I did this. I used your house as an expense because such. You'd be like, yo, but I really don't work from home. Like, right, so. And it's like, so basically you can say, you know what? It's not a big deal. Or you can say, you know what? Nah, because this may come back to haunt me.
Yeah.
You can continue, I guess, but I'm gonna put this hand out.
But like, first,
you can continue, but shut up for a second. No, but what I was going to interject though, really quickly, is that like the conflict that you're feeling, Dan, about it, I think is it bypasses a part of this that we're talking about, in that I believe Governor Rick Snyder should have due process. Like, all I'm saying is that he should be accountable answer this. I'm not saying he's immediately convicted. He's serving time. He's, you know, whatever. I'm saying that he's indicted. He has to answer for this in a court of law. He can provide all the bit of evidence to say, like, hey, I made this decision based off of these. I was, you know, I want him to have a robust defense about why he did this. But we're owed that. The people of Flint are owed that. He needs to answer to that under threat of perjury, under, like, that's my thing.
Gotcha.
And so
I totally agree.
So yeah. Like, the idea of just saying, like, he immediately, your head cut off, like, nah, it's like, no, but you do have to account for this in a court of law.
I agree. I'm expecting a New Jack City type of thing. I want him to
you want him shot outside the courtroom.
I want him to get his due process, but I want some scurly old black dude just to run up on him and and I want him to fall from, like, the fourth floor.
Fall all the way down.
I'm just playing. I don't want that. I do. I agree with John. I think it's necessary if we, but the concern with that is usually the system doesn't work in favor of those who are on the wrong end of the situation.
And, I mean, so I don't know if anyone's holding their breath for an indictment, right?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Unfortunately.
Man. But I would like a jury of his peers to be 12 Flint residents.
Absolutely.
How about that?
Right.
How about that?
Absolutely.
All right. So let's close with this. It's Black History Month.
It is.
Black History Year.
Or if David were here, he'd say Black Future Month.
Black Future Month. Yeah. Black Presence Month.
David, mm-hmm. You missed your opportunity. I guess you'll have one more in 2 weeks. But
we doing this in 2 weeks.
I can't believe we're not going to talk about the Super Bowl either.
Oh, we can give our predictions.
We can give predictions, but that's a different podcast. Go check out 4th and 10.
Just because they talk sports, I mean, we can't talk sports.
I agree.
True.
I'm an athlete, well, we can talk.
I would love to get one.
Y'all got me up here. It's 12 o'clock. Book. I might as well just
stay on. We should go to Waffle House after this.
I already ate, man. I ate before.
Shoot.
Next time.
I look over at a dawn.
Next time. I think I had an argument with somebody who said they thought Waffle House was better than. I mean, they said IHOP was better than Waffle House.
That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I almost
punched him in
the
lip.
You should have punched him in the throat.
Almost.
And then the lip.
I was like, you're dumb.
That's as bad as someone saying that Peyton Manning has a chance in this game.
He absolutely does. But that dude's arm, I think I could throw the ball better than he can right
now. Cam Newton is going to make the Broncos look terrible.
Their defense is dope, though. I will say that much.
Their defense is the real deal.
Denver's defense is the only.
I don't think you can sustain that for four quarters, though.
I don't think so either.
Cam getting injured in the first quarter is their only hope of winning this game.
Or he just having a terribly bad game. Like, it's like a game like of the like so atrocious. It's like. People start questioning, like, did you throw that game?
Here's the thing. Like, they sustained it against New England, but it's because it was Tom Brady.
Exactly.
And that...
It's a totally different...
You're not 240 pounds.
But none of that.
Six, however tall Cam Newton is. But none of that. Like, that mobile.
New England didn't have a running game.
No.
New England doesn't have a wideout who's going to stretch the field like Ted Ginn. And
Brown. That's the first time Ted Ginn's been talked about positively in so long.
I mean, he can stretch the field.
But he stretches the field. Like, he may just drop it. He may drop it.
My dear Ohio State.
He's the
Buckeye
guy that's like, we just want you to run the fly route every time, and we're probably not going to throw it to you that much. But
we're going to throw it to you three times and just catch one of them, bro. Just catch one of them.
I think the Panthers' best hope is that Wade Phillips is the defensive coordinator for the Broncos. And I say that knowing that he's a great defensive coordinator. Yeah. But he also...
You just got these Dallas flashbacks, like, in your mind.
He is carrying the mojo of being the terrible Dallas head coach, and he just can't win the big one.
Yeah, I don't know.
So like this, who do you want to see? Like from the perspective of
this is,
like...
This is that Super Bowl that I hated to have to, because part of me actually likes Peyton Manning.
Yeah, you want to see him...
I want to see him in his career.
In his career. Like,
cheering for the white Bronco.
There you go. OJ, the OJ.
I think it sucks that Eli has one more than him. That's what bothers me.
I do too.
It's like,
where's the justice?
Part of me loves it because I was always like the messed up, like, kind of like sibling that didn't ever do anything right. And so like the fact that the jacked up sibling has one more off the like clean cut one is kind of fun.
It's just
Peyton. That's so hilarious.
Yeah, it's so true.
I'm just like,
but I love Cam Newton though. I love Cam man, Newton. College man, Park Cam.
Man,
on my street they have a sign that says Cam Newton, home of the Heisman Trophy winning Cam Newton. So it's like,
yeah,
I see it every day when I turn down my street. I see the sign. So part of me loves the fact that Cam is there, and right, I love his personality.
I do too.
I love the fact that he has fun. I think he's an amazing athlete.
Yeah,
man. I don't know, and I like to watch their team play.
Yeah, they've stolen the mojo that Seattle had.
Yes,
to where like if you didn't have like a dog in the fight, you just would want to watch Seattle play
exactly
a game because you're just like, man, it's just fun watching them play.
Yep.
That's
boys what, hit. They hit. Oh, they're all over the field. They have fun. Yeah,
what Josh Norman,
want,
dude.
I just want a good game. I don't want like a 28-0 halftime.
So you don't want the Seattle Broncos game
exactly.
The Super Bowl three
years ago. I think that's what it's going to be. I think because I just don't think
Cam's up 28-3 at halftime.
I don't know about 28-3, but I think it's going to be like 23 or something like that.
Put it like I think the defense, Denver's defense is going to score their first touchdown. I guarantee it.
Because there's no way that Peyton throws three touchdowns in this game.
Nah,
but he's got, if he throws three touchdowns in this game, the Broncos win.
No,
I will say that. That's my number.
Interesting.
I think Carolina scored more than three touchdowns.
Yeah, I'm giving the Broncos defense a touchdown, and I'm giving Peyton three, and I know they're not going to run it in. Yeah, so I think they scored
28-31 with a field goal or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
I think that could do it.
I cannot fathom Peyton Manning throwing three touchdowns.
Neither can I.
No, he's not.
Which is why I picked Carolina, but
I was blown away that like when I was getting the updates, I saw he through two like mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just I don't know, but yeah, man, I think that's the only downfall about New England not being in the Super Bowl is that all of their Super Bowls are extremely entertaining to watch.
Yeah, even though you hate them.
I
think everybody hates New England outside of New England.
Absolutely. But it makes it super, like, even the ones they've lost, they've been super interesting to watch.
Yeah,
so I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think they've ever won a Super Bowl over more like over three or four, like a touchdown, right?
Say that again.
None of their Super Bowls.
No,
they've are over all, a touchdown score.
It's been like 3 to 6 points. Yeah, it's not. Yeah, they've not been. They've never been like two touchdowns up. Like it's crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy. Now I think about it.
It's they're super excited.
But so when you talk about it, like them jokes. Well,
Black Panthers or White Broncos.
Oh gosh, is this the kind of conversation your friends have? You guys have like
4th and 10.
This was 4th and 10.
Yeah. Oh really? Oh,
that was the title for 4th and 10.
I'm going to the Black Panthers.
Black Panthers, because they're in black, and the Broncos are in white.
They're wearing black, all black,
all black.
Are you serious?
Yeah,
I didn't know that part.
Black jerseys for sure.
Are you serious?
Yeah,
I definitely want to see this game.
And then Denver is putting.
I knew Denver was
wearing the white.
Was not wearing the orange because they said they lost the Super Bowl.
Yeah,
they got blown out by Seattle. Yeah,
exactly. So they were like, we're staying away from the orange jerseys, but for them to wear all white is pretty cool, and then for them to wear all black is pretty dope too. I think the NFL has this is my concern with the NFL. Two things that the NFL has to change ASAP. One, they have to change their sock rule. Because those white socks, like having to show white in your sock is the worst.
I didn't even notice
that. So they'll have like red jerseys and like black pants. I'm making something up. But then you have to wear like half red and half white socks.
Interesting.
I think you should wear a solid color, just one sock. But the other thing is they have to change their hats. Baseball teams have the best hats in the world because of the designs. Like they have like NY or they have a C. Like who walks around with a hat with a big like pirate on there?
Oh.
Like the Raiders or the Buccaneers. I think they should just have like a TB for Tampa Bay or like a G for Dallas.
You don't like the actual logos.
I don't like teams. To have mascots on hats. Like that's not, it just doesn't.
So you don't like the Bronco on the Broncos?
No. I don't like any, none, nothing. There's not one. At all. I think
Do you like the Cowboy Star?
No. Nothing. I think they should have letters. That's why I think this is my preference. I think basketball and NBA have the basketball and NFL have the worst like logos That's why I feel like baseball caps are the most sold and worn hats, especially within like hip hop culture. Think about
that's
it.
Interesting.
L.A. Dodgers, like the L and the A, New York, Cincinnati, Chicago. People wear baseball hats. They don't wear.
But that's because more so they like to rep their cities, though, right?
But he's saying that that's, the city should be represented on the hats. Whereas
you have the colors, but just have the city. So like LA just have
to think about this.
Well, there's
theory.
No LA team right now, but it will be.
Would DFW on their
just D?
Jersey?
Just put a D.
Yeah,
just put a
y'all
D.
Call Dallas people call it the D, which I'm like Detroit claim this.
Calvin Johnson, bro. What? Georgia Tech's own.
He's leaving like $30+ million on the table.
I hear, but
that's
hey,
how
I
bad
guess
Detroit is.
Money can't buy happiness. That's how bad exactly.
Detroit, look, I will give you $30 million if I get to leave here. That's just,
he like he.
Anyway,
I think it's mostly guaranteed too. Money.
Well, he owes $3 million. I guess I heard he has to give them back $3 million.
Really?
Yeah.
Of his guaranteed
of his, yeah,
contract.
Of his guarantee, yep.
Interesting. I mean, he's made $60 million thus far. I think he might be.
He's
all
a smart fella. I think he was like a Rhodes Scholar or something like that.
Yeah,
right?
He went to Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
You're a great receiver and you go to Georgia Tech. There, you care about education.
This is where obviously. We really get to see. Well, not that we get to see. Well, no. We know already, but what Matt Stafford. Ooh. Not.
Well, you're going to have.
You know, he was thinking about retiring. Right. After you got that call.
You sure? You sure, Calvin? You sure?
Apparently, he knew throughout the season because Calvin was told him. He was like, look, man, this is it for us, bro.
It's been a good run.
It's made sense for you. That's what
it is. I'm done. Stay here and mess with these sorry folk.
Oh man, I don't know.
You said Black History Month, and we're gonna close it. With.
Yeah. I was curious if you have one kind of thing that you would challenge people to read in Black History Month because we are about reading.
Boom! I would say Carter G. Woodson, the father of Black History, read his "The Miseducation of the Negro," because he is the one who instituted the week, right? Black History Week, which mature to grow to a month, and I think his book is
he CAU? Is he Clark?
I don't think so.
All right,
I think he's. I'm pretty sure he taught at Howard.
Okay,
I don't know where he actually attended school though.
Word,
you good? But he is his commentary on the importance of history and understanding culture and who you are is. It's paramount, and there's very few people, I mean, you could put Du Bois up there, but there's very few people other than Du Bois who can probably carry his water in the sense of why history is important for a people, and in order for him, and that's why I think it's important that we understand Black History Month, because he says it's for you to understand your identity, not just for the past, but for the future, and so that it forms dignity, it forms an appreciation of who you are. I'm gonna paraphrase one of his quotes. He's like, "But people who don't understand their history don't understand their future, right?" And so, and then he also has another quote. He says, "Most of history has been, or most of our history has been written by our slavers without any protest." Mm-hmm. And so, if that's the truth, then we have to start telling our story, understanding our history, and celebrating it. And he did a wonderful job of that. He has a lot of other writings that I think are. That he contributed. He wrote about the church. He wrote about. He just wrote about a lot of stuff. So I would say Carter G. Woodson for the purposes of Black history in general.
That's good. Oh, I was trying to think.
Sorry.
How about you, Dan?
Yeah, give me a moment.
So
who would you recommend that we study for Black history?
So I think one of the books that. You know, when you go to college, you take classes and they assign books, and after you buy them, you turn them back in so you can get that cash money back.
Absolutely.
That's so true.
Absolutely.
But this book was one that I was like, after I read it, I was like, I'm going to hold on to this book forever. And that's Walking with the Wind, John Lewis's memoir of the Civil Rights Movement. And just his ability to, I think a lot of times there's like, we sensationalize things, but we also kind of put down certain things. And he gives a human element to the civil rights movement that I just had never received prior, where he just talks about the personalities and the people, and you get to see the human side of Dr. King, and you get to see, like, read about the doubts and the successes and the failures, and instead of just kind of this overarching kind of like nonviolent idea and how it was successful, but there's real people behind these sit-ins and the lunch counter, and he was at so many of these things, Lee and Snick. So that would be definitely the book that I would say read it. It's good. It's long, but it's good.
Gotcha.
That's excellent. Good. I don't know if I was trying to think of like a book. It's funny. I don't know. I just think that there's just so many amazing people that you should just take the time to look into. I often talk about how amazing George Washington Carver was. He's heralded, but I don't think like heralded to the extent that he should be. And like when you look at the like how many patents he has and the
well, amount, he actually doesn't own any patents from what I understand, right?
Well,
he had over like hundreds of inventions, but never felt like he intentionally didn't want to create patents because he believed that they were the Lord's and not his.
Wow.
Which at some point you're like, oh man, that's spiritual. <burn.">
Give that money to the church, bro.
Exactly. Something. Keep it to your family. That's part of the reason why black folk ain't got no wealth, man. We too spiritual.
Facts. But yes. All good. No, that's good. But Tuskegee's own.
Tuskegee!
Skiggies.
I'm sorry. I'm a piss. Give me a minute.
Yeah. But Tuskegee tears. But anyway, I just think, just really look at the life of someone like George Washington Carver. And then I would, and just from there, when you know, I think that it'd be important to look at the like prophetic legacy of someone like Henry Highland Garnett. In terms of just actually like preaching and the idea of what truly you can do as a like using sermonic rhetoric and combining the idea of your blackness and yet Christianity in this tumultuous time. It's just amazing. And then finally, along that line of sermonic rhetoric, the book I would recommend would be The Fire Next Time, James Baldwin, who is probably the greatest essayist. Just greatest American essayist, I would say. I would say of the 20th century, but wow. that's my.
Oh, James Baldwin.
Is that essay out there just to go grab?
Or is it The Fire Next Time?
Yeah.
It's a book.
It's a book.
Yeah, okay. Two essay. It's two particular.
It's kind of like where your boy Tatsubidi. Ta-Nehisi. It's where Ta-Nehisi got his concept.
It's why his was two as well.
Okay.
Two long chapters or whatever.
Yeah.
But honestly, everything Baldwin, and even if you look up his interviews and you see like the level of clarity of thought that he provided, here you have this black gay man who has this level of like just coherent thought about who he is and where his life is at he's like many people during this time who found themselves overseas getting a different perspective of their blackness in America, like having to go overseas and get this. And so
it's also interesting to see him and his beef with Malcolm X too.
Mm-hmm.
So, because oftentimes we don't like today we don't get to, you know, I guess you could say, see the tension in the midst of it because we romanticize all of history all the time.
Sure.
And nobody had any disagreements. Everybody agreed. Everybody loved the civil rights movement. There were a lot of people who criticized MLK. There's a lot of people who didn't agree with nonviolent movements and stuff like that. So, and to see kind of like two pillars of black history go at it, kind of like, or to have some disagreement.
Along that line too, for people who, you know, we just gave y'all books, and if y'all want to read, go watch the Black Power mixtape, which is, I think it's on Netflix. Yeah, I think it's still on Netflix. It should be. But definitely watch that. Because what you have there is like actual interviews during this time between, you know, where you'll see Stokely Carmichael, you'll see, you know, various people just talking, but you also have overdubs of conversation of, you know, Questlove or Talib Kweli or whomever, like talking about their impressions as they're seeing this, because this is all footage that I think was taken from a, from like a Swedish news crew or something like that. And they just it was like unseen footage that they had from the 60s and from this era. And that, so they ended up putting this out there and combining it in a super compelling way. And I think one of the things that speaks even to what you were talking about, Dan, is that you see these people in very, you don't see them in just their elevated positions. Mm-hmm. You see them like behind the scenes and you realize these aren't just, they didn't just live in books or live in these speeches. They were like real life human beings who had mothers and their mothers had concerns about their lives, but yet they were still dedicated and focused on this, you know, it, whatever. So
when I think to finishing up, I think that's what I love about, because then you understand the sacrifice that was made.
Absolutely.
Because without that humanity, the sacrifice, it's almost,
it becomes something that's too lofty. You're like, man, I'll never, you know, I know me, I like to watch NFL Super Bowls, and
or
I could care less.
I watch The Bachelor with my wife.
Right. I can't possibly aspire to this greater ideal. And you see that these people were like, it was a day in, day out living thing that these people did. So, yeah.
Good
bro,
stuff.
Can I interrupt this and say that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are 0.2, apparently, with 98% of the reporting.
It's crazy.
They're 0.2 points away.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Like, I never thought that would be the case. Then Bernie Sanders, people love Bernie Sanders, bro.
Why does Iowa get to choose?
Yeah, first of all,
they don't.
Iowa,
they never have. So let's be clear about this. Yeah. They never have chosen.
They've never chosen correctly.
Right.
But
two
I'm
out
just
of
saying,
the last eight presidential cycles, the winner of Iowa for their respective parties went on to win the candidacy. One was Obama, ironically. Mm-hmm, so right. One was recent. And then I'm not sure who the other one was, but in reality, very
Reagan,
rare.
I'm just gonna throw that out there. I don't know.
Very rarely do they get it right.
Right.
What they tend to do is bring
drop
underdogs
people
out. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They tend to either, if you're an underdog and you don't show up in Iowa, you tend to drop.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. If and then other times, underdogs kind of find some momentum. The problem is you do Iowa and then New Hampshire, and you can underdogs can typically kind of rally and kind of do some things there, and then you come
South Carolina.
But don't we think that Ohio, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and maybe Illinois are a better representation of what the national view or poll would look like, because those states seem to be more split? Like Iowa is, there's like, I mean, I guess you could say it's a mix of conservative and liberal, but I would say Ohio.
We are the bell curve. We are the bell curve
like
state.
I would say those should be the states we probably lead off with if you're trying to get a good indication of what the nation thinks about.
The other thing is that if I'm not mistaken, and we are so trampling on plead the fourth, so forgive us, Doc. But New Hampshire and Iowa, those are both proportional delegates. Right.
I don't know.
I believe you can still get like a portion of those delegates. Like if you don't win, if you come in second, you still get a portion of those. Whereas when you get to the others, it's
you,
all
you
like
win the delegation of that.
You
state.
Win all of them as opposed
well,
to
as far portion. As the delegates. Clinton has 28. Sanders has 21. Cruz has 8. Trump and Rubio have 7. And so those are the significance right
Trump
now.
Trump and Rubio ended up together.
Yeah, as far as the
what
after
so
all of that talking,
I think you're about to see Rubio
exactly
struggle through through New Hampshire, and then when he comes south, Rubio, you're gonna be like,
I mean, he has the establishment backing. Like they are like please.
Oh, everybody won, but I think this actually is gonna calm some nerve with Trump not winning. like outright the delegates and the percentage.
Or it's going to cause him to go independent and then cause the whole world to spin upside down.
Yeah. Well, did you guys see that there was some talk about Bloomberg?
Yes, did see this. He said he'd put $1 million. No, it was a lot of money. It was a billion dollars.
He has a few if you wanted to.
Oh yeah, I mean he has the money, but I'm not impressed with Bloomberg. I don't know, like
No.
He doesn't blow my mind.
I wouldn't think that. But just simply here you have someone who presided over New York and by most measures outside of the horrible class difference that you know, the class inequity that occurred under him improved New York in terms of a lot.
So is he,
but as a spoiler on the, like, if you're talking about Trump showing up on the right,
he would be a spoiler
as an independent.
But I think Bernie Sanders is that spoiler.
Is Bloomberg further left than?
No, nobody's further left than Bernie Sanders. I don't think anybody in the world.
Doc might be.
I haven't listened to
that. And the whole thing, though, about Bloomberg, though, is that he's not. I think what would stop him is because he likes Hillary. Like, he's not, you know.
He doesn't want to steal her, her moment.
But
it's going to be
if she doesn't win this time, though, she dumb.
Is she dumb or
done? Okay.
Done.
I thought you said
no. Oh, absolutely.
N-E.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. She's not like Chester MacArthur. I think Arthur is the only person who won, lost, and then came back and won a third. Am I correct? Is it Arthur MacArthur or is it Chester? I don't know. I forgot what president it was.
Grover, Garfield. I don't know. I'm just naming random folks.
It was somebody in like late 1800s.
McKinley.
No, it wasn't McKinley. Definitely wasn't McKinley. Okay. But anyway.
That's Ohio.
I'm impressed. So Huckabee dropped out today.
Did he?
Yeah.
Good for him.
In 2008, didn't he win Iowa?
Yes, he did, actually.
Yeah, he did.
He did.
I just know that he's ridiculous.
He is absolutely ridiculous.
You know, look.
Do you not defend Huckabee on this show?
No, I'm not. Well, I mean, I don't hate the guy, but.
I hate him. No, I'm just if I saw him on the street, he gonna get it.
He would make all the unauthentic Christian songs.
Oh gosh!
In my world,
yeah,
probably would. I don't know. Did you see the videos of Mark Rubio sharing his faith?
Yes.
You didn't like them?
No, they felt genuine.
They felt real genuine. Mm-hmm. They felt extremely genuine.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Because there's people who talk about their faith and you're like, that's fake.
Two Corinthians.
Well, sure.
And it's even like you're regurgitating what you've learned. Like you're pulling from the back of your mind, like, this sounds right. Like he was just like it was natural. He was
interesting.
And then there's a second video with him responding to an atheist asking him.
So that's the one I've seen.
Oh, there's another video where he actually walks through the gospel message, and it's the most amazing. It's better than a lot of pastors I've seen. I was like, this dude is killing it right now.
So again, I think he's gonna come south, and then he's gonna get Texas. Mm. He's just about to. Which actually. Now that I say that, what's his name is
Cruz?
Cruz is from Texas, so that would be interesting. Mm-hmm. But I think with immigration, he could get a run for his money in Texas. We'll see.
Well, the Koch brothers is giving him that money, right? So
they will.
He should win a lot of the South.
There's an article also. I'll send it around, but there's an article about like how the Koch brothers develop strategy. Uh-huh. It is fascinating. It is like there's polling that shows like how it's affected, and so like, you know, they take an issue. I don't want to mess this up, but basically they will find a professor that has a view that they like or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they will provide resources for that professor to publish a little bit more and write a little bit more, and they try to identify someone in an Ivy League because the idea is that if it's in the Ivies, then everyone will follow or whatever. But they'll take one; it might just be a random one-off, whatever. So they find that professor to write these pieces or whatever. So then, by that same token, then they create these policy groups and these policy wonks that take whatever that professor wrote about and then they create policy around this, and they just constantly reference that professor's studies or that professor's thoughts on it that then create these long-standing like policies. Then these policies are then called upon by the legislators and congressmen, and they can say, well, we're seeing studies that show blah, 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 blah. And like literally they will take issue by issue this way to where you see something like climate, you know, like environment, you know, environmental and climate change. And like they did a study that even from 2010, once they really honed into that, how it's so much more of a guessing game now with the American public with regards to how people, I don't really know if man-made, if we actually are causing any of this, and if it, and it's just, it's fascinating. Like, you're like, wow, like how this actually works.
It's stuff like that when I hear people say that.
But this is the thing, though, I agree with that. The liberals do the same thing. It just came out that George Soros gave $8 million to the Hillary Clinton administration. George Soros backs the same dude who supports every gay agenda in America, also has had meetings with Black Lives Matters movement and supports and sponsors them. So it's no coincidence that a lot of Black Lives Matters movement has the LGBT connection. And they do the same thing. So the liberals do the same thing.
Hold on. Wait one second, though.
And I'm sure that was a liberal media outlet who wrote that article and kind of explained and broke it down.
I mean,
what I'm not saying is that that's cool, but what I'm saying is they all do it.
So can I at least
come back with my statement around this?
Yes, because
the pushback that I would provide is that what we're talking about with those two particular things, they're not equitable. In the sense of, the reason why I don't think it's exactly the same is that what the Koch brothers are doing in that sense, they're doing because I feel like their argument is, we have to do this because let me go at it the other way. The reason why I don't think the liberal side is that calculating on that level is because I think the argument could be made that the higher education in general just leans that way regardless. And so the idea isn't that we don't have to tactically create this money, prop up this professor, then connect this. Like, it's not that. And actually, the other thing that article brings out is that there was a liberal fundraising get together where a bunch of multimillionaires and billionaires got together and tried to follow the exact same model as the Koch, and they couldn't get buy-in from liberal because they were just like, what's the point? Like, they didn't see the strategy of it. They didn't understand that part of it. So that's why I'm like, it's not a one-to-one comparison in terms of methodology.
Not with saying just liberal, but what I will say, that if you study the narrative, you study how the LGBT community in general became very prominent, it's pretty much they did the same thing. Like, they got a lot of, what was the term? They got academics. They got folks to speak on the behalf of the cause. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of resources and funding. They, in some ways, bought off a lot of, so like, for instance, if you go to like the Urban League, you go to the NAACP, you go to their websites, right? These are movements that were struggling at one point in time, but you find a movement that says, hey, we'll fund you. Just kind of like, you know, scratch our back, we'll scratch your back. And so now these movements, all of a sudden they have, you know, LGBT or flags and banners on their website. And a lot of these organizations have nothing to do with human rights. They're just, one is a business, it could be like a business organization, but they have this LGBT banner on their site. Like, what does this have to do with anything, right? Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it may be the same ends, but they go about it in different means. So both of them are trying to push an agenda that gets affirmed in academia. Mm-hmm. And I do agree with your point. Like, most higher education already leans liberal anyway, so you don't necessarily need the validation in the university. But you definitely needed it in policy, because we forget that even Democrats, like even liberals, weren't really pro-homosexuality. Like that's a new phenomenon within the last 10, 15 years. Because even Democrats were conservative in that. Like, so you look into like what Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. even Obama, who at one point in time was gay, was openly gay. Openly.
news. Hot take.
News flat.
Even Obama. You said it with some conviction, too. Like, even Obama, who was openly gay.
Yeah,
like,
I should have kept going with it. It just felt. Even Obama, who at one point in time was openly for gay marriage, stepped away from that for a moment because he didn't think he would be electable by having that particular view, and then later, once he got elected, went back to supporting gay marriage. So the goal was for the far left to get liberals and Democrats to, you know, champion their agenda, and they did a wonderful job. They did a masterful job at creating a narrative, getting people to understand it, and then in some ways lobbying their way onto I guess you can say the platform of other organizations that fight for civil rights and oppression, which I think is genius, just like the Koch brothers. Though I think both of them were very, it's just lobbying in general is just a dirty game. It's very smart. It's very, it's tricky business, but it's dirty. And so,
yeah, just to name check it. It was a book. It's a book called Dark Money by by Jane Mayer, and she is she works for the New York Times, so I guess if you believe that the New York Times is a liberal,
I definitely believe the New York Times is a liberal.
All right,
there's no more liberal outlet than the New York Times.
I think there probably is a more liberal outlet than the New York Times.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Okay,
but
jeez,
I read everybody. I'll read anybody and everybody, but I know liberal outlets and I know conservative outlets. It's just, it is what it is. And you have a base, and the New York Times, they're liberal, but I love folks who write with New York Times. I think Peter Weiner writes for the New York Times every now and then. He's a conservative, if I'm not mistaken. He may be the one.
I'm sorry. She's of the New Yorker, not New York Times.
I don't know about the New Yorker, but I know they've had some racist posts about Obama, so they may not be. I don't know.
They have a lot of different writers.
I know what's the name wrote for them pretty often as well. My guy, Gladwell.
Dr. Jelani Kyle writes for them too. Yeah. Used to work at Spelman. This
anyway,
is the longest ever.
Yeah,
we're giving y'all too much.
Yeah. So, happy Black History Month.
Look, man, this is when you had me up this late. I'm taking the most of it.
I appreciate that. Hey, thank you guys for tuning
in.
It's
1:30.
Oh, yeah, it's 1:30, bro. It's not for these people that are listening though, so we gotta be happy about it.
Just know we were up at 1:30 in the morning doing this for you.
Yes. So that person who commented on Show's thing and said these need to be more consistent, grind harder. Did you see that, dude?
I didn't see that.
Just calling you out.
Was it on my Facebook page?
I think it was on your Facebook. Like, you had posted the thing and he said, grind harder. I'm like, man, shut up. Thank you for listening, but shut up.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
but seriously, comment. Tell us what you think about it. If you can
rate. One of the posts I put, I was like, the dopest podcast in Atlanta is back again. And then somebody posts, back to and to only disappear for another 9 months. I was like,
fair. Fair. If you could comment, like us on iTunes, talk to us on FourthDistrict.com, engage with us. We do this every other week. This is Fourth District's Unfiltered staff podcast, and we just kind of talk about the happenings of the world in music, politics, and culture, trying to curate that high living and high art, first popularized by this hip-hop artist named Amisho Baraka. So thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you next time. Peace. Open, and I'm the maestro for this certain moment, trying to take it sky high, so go alert the stoners, fear got your guy almost on the verge of blowing it, bribe.